If you're just tuning in, this is the KHSU Magazine. I'm your host, Lorna Bryant. The Bleeding Edge is an eye-opening look at the fast-growing medical device industry, and it reveals how the rush to innovate can lead to devastating consequences for patients. This according to Netflix. Joining me in the studio today is Tamara Myers. Tamara is a patient advocate from Eureka. She was featured in the documentary that will make its wide release tomorrow on Netflix. Tamara, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with your story. What brought us to today?
Well, in 2012, I was 36 years old. I was done having children. I heard about this great new product. I'd never had a surgery before and wasn't keen to have one. So I heard about this sterilization device, and it was advertised as very quick, very easy, minimal amount of pain. You could be back to work the next day, no side effects, very little side effects. Most women have such an easy time of it. And at the time, you know, I'm a mom, a working mom. I have a very physical job. I was detailing antique cars. It was a very physical job, and the idea of no downtime sounded perfect. So I made an appointment, went through the process, and it sounded like it couldn't be better.
Outpatient medical visit or in the doctor's office? What?
It was done in a clinic.
Okay.
So it was outpatient setting. I didn't have to go to the hospital. I could just go into, you know, regular clinic and have it done. It's supposed to be an hour procedure, and then I could go home.
So what was your experience?
My experience was very different than what I thought it would be. It was an extremely painful procedure. It was hard to describe what that procedure felt like.
Wow.
It was not what I thought it was. They had a lot of difficulty placing the device. I was not at all prepared for the amount of pain that was experienced during that procedure.
No local anesthetic at all?
No, it was, they gave me, I think it was like a shot of Toradol. That was what.
And what is that?
It's like what I understand, it's like what they explained it to me as was like a big dose of ibuprofen.
Okay.
So.
And that wasn't effective, I'm guessing?
That was not effective. Okay. These devices go basically into your fallopian tube. So they have to, you know, it's a very, they say it's non-invasive, but it is quite invasive.
Okay, so they don't penetrate your skin, they go vaginally?
It goes through the cervix and into the fallopian, through the uterus into the fallopian tubes.
Okay. And what is the name of this device?
It is called eSure.
Okay. And describe what it looks like.
There are two coils. They describe them as two metal coils. It's like there's a lot of different materials, but it's basically like a metal coil wrapped around an inner polyester. So they are, you know, very small. They go into the...
So I'm thinking like a coil, what you find in a push-button pen, like a ballpoint?
You could say. I mean, something similar.
Okay.
You know.
Okay, so about that size or smaller? Or?
I think they're...
About an inch long?
So, I'm not...
Okay. So the device was inserted. Were you fine after painful experience?
It was an extremely painful... my partner would say, I thought you were going to break my hand.
Wow.
It was, and he was there reminding me to breathe through the whole experience, and which was very helpful. After the procedure, I didn't feel well. Like when you go through an experience like that, and I was thinking that, you know, okay, I'd go home, I'd rest, I'd be okay.
Just a little exhausted, maybe.
Right.
Okay.
But I continued to feel that I could feel this discomfort. And, you know, within a short amount of time, I started to feel these other symptoms. Like, I didn't feel right. I was having, like, this burning sensation. I could feel, like, pain in my abdomen that just continually progressed.
So how much of a time span was it before you sought medical attention for what you were feeling?
I believe it was about 2 weeks.
Okay, so very short
time. Very short amount of time.
Okay, and how was that experience?
The experience was that the staff at the clinic didn't really know what to do with complications. They didn't have any answers for me. I was told basically like, oh, just give it some time. The doctor who had performed the procedure, you know, relayed that, you know, this is, just give it some time. You should heal. Everything should be fine. But that wasn't the case. So I went home, gave it some time, you know, another week or two, came back. I'm like, this isn't getting any better. The symptoms were getting progressively worse. I was losing weight. I was not able to eat. You know, it was a pretty rapid progression.
Okay. So I'm guessing you visited a medical professional once again.
Yes, there were quite a few ER visits in that amount of time.
Oh, and when were you finally given some relief?
3 months later, I found at a hospital out of town, I found a doctor who was willing to remove the devices. And I did find, actually, there was a nurse at the clinic who was really trying to find answers. It's just they weren't there.
Okay. So is it because they had never encountered complications with the
possibly,
use of this? Okay. And
but I think that there was a protocol and a standard for implantation, but there wasn't really a protocol or a lot of information for the medical professionals on what to do if something goes wrong or there's no standard for removal. None.
Wow. So that leads to my next question. I'm assuming that the clinic that inserted the device, they weren't equipped to remove it?
No, they were not.
Okay, so you had to seek your own doctor to remove it on your own.
I think I saw four different doctors.
Wow.
And then went out of town to, you know, so traveling 6 hours, having to, you know, go and then discuss, like, the different options of, you know, how do you remove this? Like, you know, and at the time, I didn't really have a lot of information about what this device was or, you know, I had found a Facebook group and there was some information there, but this was, you know, sort of in the beginning stages.
So I'm assuming the removal was a surgical procedure at this point.
I had my fallopian tubes removed along with the coils.
Wow. So did the coils damage your fallopian tubes or would it have been too invasive to remove them?
You know, I don't have the pathology report on that. And but what I was told was that they didn't see anything out of the ordinary. So I was thinking, okay, sweet. I got this device removed. I can go home and, you know, get better and have a normal life. And that wasn't the case. So
this sounds cliche, but then what happened?
Right. So I did some of the more severe symptoms, like the more acute symptoms, you know, resolved with taking the coils out. But some of the lingering issues continued to get worse. So fast forward to 2014, I am still having debilitating pain. Abdominally, I'm having more of like autoimmune issue responses.
Oh, wow.
Going to doctors, trying to figure out what's going on, having digestive issues at this point. And I needed to, it finally got so bad that I had a hysterectomy in 2014. I had to go back because I couldn't function.
Wow. So, but you're still experiencing the symptoms. So it sounds like your own body has basically begun attacking itself because of this device that's not even there anymore.
Right.
And I'm assuming the pain is in the general area where your fallopian tubes were, so it's like phantom pain.
Well, you know, I still have my ovaries, so, you know, so there's still, yes, like, so I still have, and it's much, you know, fast forward to 2018, I have a lot less of the abdominal pain since my hysterectomy. A lot of that was resolved.
Okay.
But still lingering other health issues.
So you mentioned a Facebook group or a support group. Is that what brings us to today, to about this Netflix documentary.
Yes.
So tell me how that came to be.
So I knew that there was something wrong. And I was, you know, researching on the internet. I wasn't finding any information. I would talk to, you know, there was nothing to confirm, like, that there was something wrong, even though I could, you know, I knew that there was something wrong. But when you're up against, you know, like, we don't really know, maybe this is all in your head, kind of a, you know, and I stumbled across this Facebook group, and there was, I think at the time, maybe like a couple hundred women, all experiencing very similar symptoms to what I was experiencing. And so I started, you know, becoming a part of this group. And you know, at first it was a great support to like, wow, I'm not alone. This is validation.
Right.
And through that, also the healing process, you know, of learning what was in the devices. You know, fast forward to today, there's over 37,000 of us in this Facebook group.
Wow.
You know.
Nationwide, or, I mean, Facebook is international, so.
Actually, yes. We have subgroups in all of the 50 states. We have subgroups in, I think, 11 countries.
Wow.
So, and for veterans first. So it really grew into this huge movement.
So with movement and with activism comes change, I'm guessing. So what was that change?
Well, that change looked like us going to the, you know, and I will say that there is, you know, an amazing admin group in this Facebook group. These women are just incredible. And, you know, going to the FDA saying, hey, you know, what's going on? This is, you know, we're all sick and basically sort of being stonewalled.
Mm.
But, you know, being persistent and being more persistent and more persistent and filing, you know, freedom of information, you know, requests and, you know, getting meetings with the FDA and getting a lot of publicity. I think it was in 2000 and I want to say 15, we filed a citizen's petition. That was sort of like where a lot of this change started happening. And there was meetings with the FDA. Changes was issuing a black box warning and more, yes. So creating change, and it's been slow, but.
So I'm guessing the director of the Bleeding Edge, they saw this movement or momentum, and did they contact the Facebook group? Or?
They did. They contacted the admins of the Facebook group and were like, hey, we heard about you. And so the admins got together with this, you know, Kirby Dick and the other producer.
Amy
Hurdy.
Okay.
And they started filming.
So tell me about the Bleeding Edge and your... I don't want to say role, but...
No, I'm just like, there's a blip. I'm okay. Like, you know, so it was, but, you know, and every single person who's been a part of this Facebook group, every single, and it's been really an army, has played a part in getting to where we are today. You know, we have some great leadership, but it's been a group effort. So the Bleeding Edge is really a look at the $400 billion medical device industry and what happens when, you know, medical devices aren't, you know, don't perform as they are advertised and they start creating great patient harm. There are several different devices featured in the film, along with the personal stories of those who have been affected by these devices. The thing that many might find surprising is the discussion and the sort of the expose on the regulatory process for these devices and the lack of oversight.
Wow. Have there been any changes with the device eSure since this? Now, if I understand correctly, the Bleeding Edge was presented at Tribeca.
Yes.
So it has had some distribution,
yes.
But it's a wide distribution tomorrow on Netflix.
Yes.
So since there was, since the documentary was created, has there been some movement on any of these devices, specifically eSure?
Yes. And I will say there's been a lot of pre-screenings of the film, and the E Sisters, the East Shore Problems Group did a screening out in front of Bear's headquarters in New Jersey. So as a result, I think it was on the 20th, Bear announced that they will no longer be selling East Shore in the United States, which was, it's been pulled from every other country. The United States was the last to be selling it. So as of December 31st, 2018, East Shore will no longer be marketed.
Okay, and you mentioned Bear. I'm assuming Bear Pharmaceuticals.
Bear Pharmaceuticals is the manufacturer.
Wow, so that is a great triumph in itself.
Yeah.
So we are almost out of time, but you mentioned that there was a bill introduced recently. Tell me about that bill and what the significance of that is.
So the Medical Device Safety Act was introduced a while ago, and its sponsor is Brian Fitzpatrick. It's a bipartisan bill, and essentially, I encourage people to Google it, find out about it, and contact their representatives to support this bill. In 2008, during the Regal and Medtronic Supreme Court ruling, consumers, patients lost the right to seek damages when they've been injured by medical devices that have preemption status. So they essentially said that the federal preemption overweighs any state. This bill would basically restore a patient's right to seek
so redress. It'll overturn that. So
yes.
You have true patient rights.
Right.
When you've been damaged from a medical device that's supposed to help you.
That is correct.
Wow. It's remarkable that something like that even exists to necessarily need to be reversed.
Yes, that it is incredible.
Wow. So tell me what's next?
The Medical Device Safety Act is a big part of it, but there's so many different facets of the medical device industry and regulatory. For me personally, one of the things that I would like to focus on is adverse event reporting. There's this, it's completely voluntary. You know, there's this system that is voluntary. The only entities that are required are medical manufacturers. So to really get the word out about, you know, reporting adverse events and getting that awareness.
Okay. Well, Tamara, we are actually out of time. Thank you for joining me today, and I'm glad you're feeling much better, and I'm glad you are a fearless advocate for patients.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you.